Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA. On the 11th of March, 1792, a woman named Lucy Banbury joined with 1,000 others in singing a hymn of deliverance in what was to become the settlement of Freetown, Sierra Leone. For her, it was a homecoming. She had left those shores 49 years earlier as a captive bound for slavery in America. That Lucy's master was Arthur Middleton, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, is suggestive of a massive irony. Thousands of American slaves saw no promise of liberty in the American Revolution, but rather placed their hopes in loyalty to the British crown. The result was a complicated odyssey, marked by deliverance and deception, stretching across the Atlantic, just as its legacy has stretched across the centuries. My guest is Simon Chama, author of Rough Crossings, Britain, the Slaves, and the American Revolution. Simon Chama, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you for having me.
Well before I got to the end of this story, I saw it not just as a history, but as a kind of striking narrative of human character in action. And the person of the aforementioned Lucy Banbridge, of David George, and of the marvelously named British Freedom.
Right.
But also, and I think principally, in terms of the two men who dominate the book, parts one and part two. Right. Granville Sharp is the man who, of course, dominates part one. And I saw him, Simon Chama, as kind of the intellectual and spiritual driving force of the abolitionist movement on perhaps both sides of the Atlantic. Could you tell us a bit about your sense of him and his motivations?
I'm very drawn to him, and I became extremely engaged with the part he played in history, because he's one of those people who kind of back into historical destiny. They both do. But he's at an extraordinary place at an extraordinary time. His brother is a surgeon to the king, one of the many doctors to the king. But his brother, William, and this is a family from the north of England who are all occupy different. One is a businessman, the brother is a surgeon. They come together for these extraordinary concerts, sometimes played on the river. Mm-hmm. So the crucial point is that the brother is a surgeon, and once a week he has a free surgery for the poor of the city and the east of London. And one day, Granville Sharp is coming from his day job, a sort of very dull job in the ordnance office, sort of seeing to wigs and boot black for the army. And there's a black called Jonathan Strong, who's barely alive. He's sort of collapsed, really, in a line of the miserable stretching down the street. And Sharp is really horrified by this, as is his brother. And they discover Strong is one of the many escaped slaves in London, someone who'd been bound to a master, had escaped and enjoyed a period of freedom, and then had been, he'd been caught by his master and beaten very badly. Had been beaten in his service, too, as well. And that's the beginning. It has a kind of scriptural flavor of it.
Right.
Because Granville Sharp, at that point, changes his life utterly. A few years, they look after Jonathan Strong, and then a few years later, his master abducts him again. And the only way for him to be redeemed, as Granville Sharp would have said, would be through the English common law, through the law court. So this very unworldly man teaches himself the law. And the point of his departure is the belief, rather utopian, that it was in the nature of British institutions, especially the courts, to make slavery in metropolitan Britain itself impossible and illegal. And from that article of faith, abolitionism begins.
Indeed. As he finds his mission, Simon, in this way, in this marvelous, romantic, but deeply grounded way, and pursues the accursed thing. I mean, the biblical echoes throughout this book are really quite striking. He pursues the case of Jonathan Strong as a legal matter, I believe, and then two other lawsuits.
And then Thomas Lewis and James Somerset.
And it's the Somerset case in particular that really advances our story, because Somerset, now, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I take it he is a slave whose master wants to take him back to Jamaica or the West Indies.
And sell him.
Right. And the case turns on this, does it not? The right of this master to transport this man.
That's right.
And here's the interesting thing, and one of the great ironies about history, I'm sure you as a historian can really help us reflect on this. It's really a misinterpretation of what the courts say on
this case.
That sets everything in motion.
That's absolutely right. When the case of Somerset came before Lord Chief Justice Mansfield in the King's Bench, he eventually does rule that in the case of this particular person, it was illegal, actually, to coerce him against his will to be taken, to be transported out of the country. He is at great pains not to say this would prejudice the rights of other slave owners. For example, there's slave owners who'd come from the West Indies with a body servant, or come from Philadelphia with a body servant. What was the legal status of those people? And Mansfield was temperamentally deeply conservative, although ambiguous in his own morality about what he felt about the institution. But he took this very kind of narrow line that he was ruling essentially ad hominem. That's not the way it was read, right, either by those who owned slaves or in the slave trade in Britain, who said this is a shocking thing that's happened to us, but who went on conducting auctions and went on conducting their business. But more particularly, we know from subsequent writing and from some of the accounts at the time that there were African British, as we should call them really, in the King's Bench at the time and afterwards, who understood this ruling entirely in terms of having made slavery illegal in Britain itself.
Right, and doesn't that news, Simon, actually travel across the Atlantic?
It does.
It has a galvanic effect on
American slaves. It's extraordinary that it does so. Mm-hmm. And the way we know that, that's the first thing out there that we know, is that 2 years later, a series of runaway advertisements to secure runaway slaves appear in the Virginia Gazette. But the judgment was given in 72. We're talking about 73, 74, so not long, which say Pompey, Cato, Lucy, and so on, run away to the British in the belief that they will be free in Old England. And subsequently, we know from the accounts given by some of the blacks themselves that this half-mythic, half-true understanding that you could reach British freedom, British justice, was an enormously galvanizing, had an enormous magnetic effect on
this is happening
what
in the,
happened when the revolution started.
Indeed, and this is happening in the early 70s. But as tensions build between the colonies and Britain, the advertisements get reinforced, so to speak, by formal invitations, don't they? I mean, Governor Dunmore
yes,
in Virginia.
Yes, that's right.
General Henry Clinton.
Yes, what happens is we've got a sort of basis of principled, if not idealistic, legal decisions happening, the rumour of those decisions sowing the seeds for a belief in the King's justice. And at that point, for wholly non-idealistic reasons, the last governor of Virginia and some of his colleagues in the other southern colonies decide, having been abandoned by troops, which are all in Massachusetts Bay, for reasons called Lexington and Bunker Hill, that their only chance, really, of holding on until they can be reinforced is to raise a slave insurrection, to raise a slave army. So in November 1775, a proclamation is issued on board one of His Majesty's ships by Lord Dunmore saying any slaves leaving rebel plantations, notice this didn't apply if you're on a loyalist plantation, would, in return for service to the king, be granted freedom. And this is, as it were, with a very small r, a revolutionary moment.
Now, after the Revolutionary War in 1783, when America had won and had gained its independence, conditions began to worsen for slaves, I get the impression. And matter of fact, one of the strong points of the book is the personal testimony. And let me quote on this point directly from a slave named Boston King. I'll just read a couple of sentences from one of his statements. And this is 1783, and he's writing about the fate of slaves after the Revolutionary War. About this time, peace was restored between America and Great Britain, which diffused universal joy among all parties except us, who had escaped slavery and taken refuge in the English army. For a report prevailed at New York that all the slaves were to be delivered up to their masters. Many of the slaves had very cruel masters, so the thought of returning home with them embittered life to us. So, I mean, that's just a sense.
Does that not turn
feeling
the revolution upside down?
Right.
It really does, doesn't it? If you put yourself there, life in occupied British New York, as it were, I shouldn't say occupied, it's an anachronism, was no picnic. Many of them lived way downtown in a kind of an encampment. Some of them indeed had jobs as servants, but nonetheless, none of them had any interest in going back to North Carolina. They were free. Their marriages were legal. There were legal baptisms. They had their own churches. It was a transformed life for them.
Right.
And the prospect, as Boston King says, of slave hunters taking people out of their beds in the middle of the night and mm-hmm. back in manacles to where they come from was utterly terrifying. And so getting one of these little documents, this is a kind of funny moment. The war is over, but the final peace treaty has not been signed, and there's still a very large British garrison in New York. So the British, if they chose to honour the obligation that the king had offered, were in a position to sort of make that happen. If, right. in fact, George Washington, on behalf of his fellow, who is himself deeply conflicted about the propriety of slave owning, but if George Washington wants to make this notorious Clause 7, there should be no carrying off of Negro stick, he has to restart the war.
Which he does not want to
which
do.
Which he does not want to mm-hmm. do.
Now, Britain honouring that obligation of freedom, is that what, at least in part, motivates the idea of resettling so many of these people in Nova Scotia?
Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, in some ways, again, motives are mixed, as they are in all the most important histories, I think. Mm-hmm. The fact is that Britain is not ready for this catastrophe that's befallen this huge loyalist population, both black and white, mm-hmm. in America, is slightly embarrassed about it. The Metropolitan British Government, the new government, Lord Shelburne's government, just wants the problem to go away. It will go away if the loyalists were rich enough and could come back and settle in Buckinghamshire or somewhere. Mm-hmm. Other than that, they have to be found a place to go to, and that place turns out to be Nova Scotia, because mm-hmm. it's thought to be potentially very prosperous, and it's certainly underpopulated.
Right.
So they want this all to go away. They are prepared kind of legally to honour the commitment made to the blacks who'd actually serve the crown. But they certainly, the British government at home, was not really prepared to extend itself unduly to see the critical part of the deal, which was getting land, was right. actually honoured and enforced. And out of that, a lot of misery and heartbreak happened. And the possibility of Sierra Leone comes out of
right.
a look across mm-hmm. the ocean at what might have been happening mm-hmm. in Canada by those who'd already flirted with the idea of Sierra Leone as a place for the black veterans who'd been very impoverished right. in London themselves.
How instrumental was Granville Sharp in that look of, at Sierra Leone as kind of the next destination?
Yes,
of
he was crucial in that. He'd spoken to two philanthropists, but one very improbable man in a story which is full of improbable people, who was an expert on termites, called Henry Smeathman.
Smeathman, right.
Smeathman had spent a year in the islands opposite the Sierra Leone River collecting ants and beetles. And he, as was the case with a lot of scientists like Banks and so on, he was also, you know, thought of himself as a commercial investor. Mm-hmm. So he comes back saying Sierra Leone is African paradise. The one thing that was true was it has the best, almost the only good
harbor.
Surf-free mm-hmm. natural mm-hmm. harbour mm-hmm. in Africa, precisely, in West Africa. Mm-hmm. So he comes back to trying to sell the possibility of Sierra Leone as a viable settlement, which will be an alternative to the slave trade,
right.
where a free black population could be independent farmers producing cotton and rice and indigo and perhaps right. coffee for the metropolitan market, free of the taint of slavery.
Sharp finds this persuasive.
Sharp finds this persuasive.
Let me take a moment to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Simon Sharma, author of Rough Crossings, Britain, the Slaves, and the American Revolution. Now, Simon, there is a designation, I guess we'd say, of John Clarkson as a kind of emissary to Nova Scotia to persuade or to help persuade the Nova Scotians, as they're now known, this population of ex-slaves, that they should become the, as we said, the second settlement of Sierra Leone. This is a remarkable but very young man, 27 years old, I believe, slim as a reed, I think he's depicted in this book.
Yes.
But here's the most extraordinary thing, and I think we need to focus on this before we can say anything else. He's had a successful career in the British Navy, even at that young age. I believe he'd served in the West Indies.
In the West Indies.
Cheek by jowl with the coexisting Absolutely. With slavery.
That's right.
But never seemingly that much troubled by it, or at least he kept his feelings to himself.
That's right.
But this man is going to undertake, with total lifelong devotion, the most extraordinary sense of mission on behalf of the Sierra Leone that I think is unprecedented in history. What's your sense of John Clarkson?
Well, it is a Pauline moment. There is no doubt about that. His big brother had been trained for the church, Thomas, and as a result of the Zong, had become the public relations campaigner, really. And William Wilberforce was the man who did it inside Parliament. But Thomas Clarkson was the one who organised mass petitioning campaigns, the sugar boycott, extraordinary. So, meanwhile, little Johnny, as he was called, was off being a midshipman. And as a result of the way the American War worked out, he's only half employed. He even then has a horrible job, which his brother disapproved of running one of the press gang. People are taken right. off the streets and forced to be sailors. But he becomes secretary to his brother. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, he's a desk humanitarian mm-hmm. at that point. But you're right, George. What happens is that, extraordinarily, the ear of the government and the great and the good in London has been bent by the complaints. And however cynical the British may have been, the sense of residual decency and honour that actually these people were owed everything that ought to have been coming to them motivated them to send somebody. And it turned out to be John Clarkson. In fact, the offer he was to take to know, first of all, he was to find out whether the stories were true, whether or not they'd been betrayed and not got their land. Secondly, if that was true, there was a three-way offer. They could either join the army in the West Indies as free soldiers. Yes, I mean, what kind of, three of them did that? No thanks, a lot. Mm-hmm. They could stay, in which case, actually, measures would be taken to ensure they got land. In Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. But the conditions have been so terrible, they reduced to such destitution. Or there was this third burning utopian possibility that they would remake freedom in what became Freetown. Mm-hmm. And so Clarkson goes and he leaves us an 800-page journal. This is why we know so much about him. My mission to America, followed by the year in Africa, my mission to Africa. And he's one of those people who walks backwards into his role, and then the only way he can cope with his own sense of unworthiness is to write everything down.
Right.
And we're in the golden age of the transparent heart. So whether you're an evangelical Christian or a romantic who believed in self-confessional honesty, really, you wrote it all down. And he happened to be rather a good writer, constantly interrogating himself, constantly scrutinizing his worthiness. So we have this utterly extraordinary document, one of the most amazing pieces of writing in late 18th century literature of any kind, I think, actually. And he's barely out in the ocean from England on his way to Halifax, Nova Scotia, when he begins to say, I don't think I'm worthy of this role. And what if, and he's quite right, what if there's some skullduggery I haven't known about? What if actually the town has been burnt down so many times that all the natives are hostile? What if the government was lying and I'm just a kind of placebo, really, for discontent in Nova Scotia?
Right.
And he says, I will never be able to live with myself. In fact, he threatens to commit suicide. No one has actually called him on this. If he betrays these people who have undergone so many betrayals, he hasn't even met them yet. And he's already utterly, utterly emotionally and physically committed to this new role.
Utterly and completely and without exception. I mean, the reader almost searches for a flaw. The reader almost wants to say he's fooling himself or he's a hypocrite or like so many others and this and other stories, he's going to find his own motives conflicted. But he never does. The man seems to be a pure example of someone who's taken on a cause in the most... Well, he's called Moses.
Yes,
and I think
he
takes on this something of that aura in a totally non-condescending way, if that can be accepted.
No, I think that's true. I mean, he does have a serious argument when they're in Africa with Thomas Peters. The one thing he finds difficult to deal with, when you create a micro-free political state, it's not necessarily going to be a prolonged story of harmony, even though he builds somewhere called Harmony Hall, is really lovely. So he can't quite cope with that. Mm-hmm. But in Nova Scotia, he is so moved by what he sees of the people, and he's so moved by both their plight and their toughness and their determination to survive and their optimism about what might happen, that he does become utterly devoted. He understands things, which I suppose when we talk about them now, it's obvious, but I don't think they were then. He understands when he puts his fleet of 15 ships to go back across the Atlantic together. Mm-hmm. There'll be some people, not many, but some, who'd last seen the Atlantic as children in chains.
Right. And he says, wants this voyage to be completely unlike that
one. He says, I will travel in a hospital ship. Mm-hmm. I will exactly specify what they will eat. Mm-hmm. I will make sure that the decks are properly ventilated,
right,
that conditions are sanitary. And all that happens. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing.
It's a wretched voyage nonetheless. I mean, storms of every kind going straight across. But he does get all those 15 ships there.
That's quite
a marvel in itself.
Yes, he does.
And you're quite right that he would have some disagreement with people like Thomas Peters and others. But I think there's an ironic point you make on that, too, that as these disagreements sprung up, they were perhaps inevitable, and evidence of something that we might even call something of an American spirit. That is to say,
right,
the sense of democracy in action is not going to be tidy.
That's right.
And
that's exactly right.
That's what happens.
Yes, exactly right. And a very low threshold of resentment about being patronized, actually.
Yeah.
And the problem is that, as Clarkson instantly sees, he comes back across the ocean with people like his friend, the Dr. Charles Taylor. But meanwhile, London has sent standard issue Hanoverian, drunken, corrupt, imperialist, no goods really to Sierra Leone to look after the commercial interests.
Mm-hmm.
And Clarkson, as soon as he sees them, is actually horrified. He sees them as so much less full of probity and determination and bravery and honesty and religion,
right,
than the blacks with whom he's made such friends.
And isn't this the crux of the drama, at least at this point of the story? Because we have this direct and rather extraordinary conflict between the Granville Sharp ideal community,
yes,
that I think Clarkson bore in his heart as well.
Right.
And this,
right,
this commercial, the commercial motives of the,
right,
Sierra Leone company.
Right.
And this, I think the governors who succeed Clarkson would be Dawes and
Macaulay
and Muldoon. Who's the last one? It's not Muldoon.
Yes.
Well,
anyway, the last,
that's
one,
almost,
yes,
immaterial, but there's,
yes,
there's a steady progression away from the notion of the,
yeah,
ideal community,
right,
toward,
yeah, that's right,
the commercial.
So
colony.
In the end, it just dissolves, disintegrates into the great, huge sort of commercial monster called the British Empire.
Exactly.
So we have basically a kind of 10-year experience of a self-governing, free British African-American Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
And it, in the end, they were overwhelmed by numbers, the Maroons who come from Jamaica, from the imperatives, which are also military ones. Britain is still fighting a war against the French.
Right, right.
And the French mounted a successful raid and destroyed the South Freetown in
1794.
Occupied it for 2 weeks. And just vandalize the entire place. So all those reasons give the sort of the next British generation on an intolerance for countenancing what then seems to be an impossibly politically utopian and naive moment. So we have just this one extraordinary decade, really, in which this experiment becomes possible.
What remains, or what beyond that demise of the ideal, so to speak, Simon, remains as the legacy of the experiment, though. Because in that 10 years, and you're right, Britain would get sort of impatient,
right,
with trying this again ever,
right,
anywhere.
Right.
But I was struck by the fact that in that decade, you do have this Afro-British,
right,
Afro-American-British African,
right,
community deciding its own fate, essentially.
Right. Right. Well, I remember growing up, actually, you know, the what was then unembarrassedly called the Commonwealth, and actually Sierra Leone, we all knew a little piece about this history that had happened before Liberia. And very interestingly, African-Americans like David Walker, and who also know about it, in America in the 1820s and 1830s, and Frederick Douglass in the 1840s, make the distinction that Liberia seems to be an exercise in convenience for America. I think they're excessively generous to the British, where Sierra Leone had been a principled exercise in genuine political experiment for free blacks. So the sort of the idea of what Freetown had been at the beginning survives for a while, survives deep into the 19th century. Sierra Leone then becomes a paradigm of, you know, for a while before it's devoured alive by the horrors of civil war, which we're all too familiar with, of Westminster democracy for a while. But I think actually, in a way, and there is a second wave, which doesn't make it to Sierra Leone, but does make it to Nova Scotia.
After the 1812.
Preston, Nova Scotia, is still a free black Christian township.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful place, actually, just outside Halifax.
Right.
But I think the idea of the possibility of a black democracy survives inside Britain and feeds the abolitionist movement proper, which in the 1820s and 30s is no longer content just with the abolition of the slave trade, but wants to make the entire British Empire a slave-free zone.
Right.
And it succeeds in 1833.
To bring our story full circle, Simon Sharma, as we conclude sitting here in 2006, this is obviously a compliment to the versions of American history of the revolution that most Americans grew up with. And I think it's been said with great reason, Americans tend to content themselves with almost a child's version of that story without its many complexities. But what contribution do you see this story making to us now?
It's really important, I think, because for all sorts of reasons. Here's the first one. I think for the most understandable reasons to do with the dissatisfaction which a lot of people feel wherever they are on the political spectrum with the nature of contemporary politics now, mm-hmm. It's entirely understandable to look back to that one moment in American history, the foundation, where political leadership seemed to be wise, virtuous, strong, reasonable, and victorious. And the Founding Fathers were all those things too, but they were also human. And there also is a kind of tragic parallel story to be told. You either want your history, in my view, to be consolatory, to be a kind of feel-good blanket in which you can wrap yourself and run away from the perplexities of the present, or you can honour, shall we say, Thucydides, who began written Western history. There's a retired general. The entire point of the history of the Peloponnesian Wars leads you towards a tragic catastrophe in the expedition to Syracuse. The nobility and strength and wisdom and power of Western history is the ability to look in the mirror and sometimes see complication, ugliness, shame, difficulty, and tragedy. History is a tragic and cautionary muse. That's mm-hmm. where its nobility comes from, I think. Now, the question is, are we ready for this? Can we actually write a history of the American Revolution in which we don't just talk about Tories, but see that moment in American life as a genuine civil war with very complicated issues of allegiance? You know, when I wake up one morning and see that Mel Gibson has made a movie called Tory, ! I'll know we've moved on a bit. Guess what? I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, I would like to see it happen, but I will say, at this moment at least, thank you very much for this look in the mirror.
You're Simon welcome. Sharma. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Simon Sharma, author of Rough Crossings, Britain, the Slaves, and the American Revolution. I'm George Ziston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler, our production engineer is Anthony Barber, and our associate producer is Sharana Harris. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.